I'm Anthony Brooks in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Stock markets around the world rebounded this morning with the news that the U.S. Treasury and the Federal Reserve are moving to shore up Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the dominant providers of funding for mortgages across the country. The federal government has essentially offered to back loans made by the two corporations, whose stocks tumbled nearly 50% last week and more than 80% over the past year. To keep the giant companies afloat and to soothe the markets, the Federal Reserve is opening its so-called discount lending window to them. And the Treasury Department will seek authority so that it can buy equity in the companies if needed to keep them solvent. Nariman Baravesh is chief economist at Global Insight, an economic analysis firm outside of Boston. And Nariman, I guess the government's plan stops short of an outright bailout. It's being referred to as an indirect intervention. What does that mean?
Basically, what it means is that the Federal Reserve and the U.S. Treasury are willing to lend on a short-term basis money to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac in case they need it. The worry is that these two mortgage giants are going to run out of money. And so what the Fed and the Treasury is saying is we will not only provide this implicit guarantee that they've been providing for the longest time, but also we're happy to lend if they need it on a short-term basis.
And do you think, is it enough, or might Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac still collapse the way Bear Stearns did, for example?
It's a little hard to tell if it's going to be enough, in part because the fate of both Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac depends very much on what happens in the U.S. housing market. When do we hit bottom? How much further will house prices fall? So the honest-to-goodness answer is we don't know. But the good news is, at least there's this backstop now that's being provided by the Treasury and the Fed that says even if things do get worse, that there's help on the way or there's help available.
Hmm. Will this indirect intervention by the government end up costing taxpayers lots of money?
I think it could well end up costing taxpayers money if indeed things do get a lot worse. It doesn't necessarily have to cost them, but I think our best guess is in the end it will cost them. It's a little hard to say how much. Current estimates I've heard suggest $70, $80 billion possibly. It could be much bigger than it, of course, if the housing market gets a lot worse.
And will the plan to bolster these two giant corporations ease the credit crisis and make it easier for people to get loans? Is that part of the purpose here?
In the end, there are really two goals here. One is exactly what you said, which is to make sure there will continue to be money available for mortgages, which is really what, in the end, these two mortgage giants do, is make it easier to get the funding for mortgages for most households that qualify for these conventional mortgages. But second, and very importantly, is that a lot of the debt that's issued by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac is held by a lot of foreign banks, a lot of foreign central banks. And this was partly as well a signal to them saying, you know, the U.S. government is not going to let these guys run into trouble more than they already have, so to speak, and that we will back them. And so don't worry, don't panic, don't sell your U.S. bonds in Fannie and Freddie that are backed by the U.S. government. So it was a signal as well to foreign investors.
Mm. Nariman, as you know, whether or not the government should prop up troubled financial institutions has become something of a hot political issue, particularly in the wake of the Bear Stearns collapse. But does the government really have any choice here? I mean, failure of these two institutions is not really an option, is it?
That is correct. In fact, you know, I know there's some queasiness, a good deal of queasiness about sort of one more guarantee here, one more bailout. But I think the alternatives, as you're saying, are far, far worse. I mean, if we let Fannie and Freddie collapse, basically, that's the worst case scenario. Then we're looking at I would say, without too much exaggeration, a repeat of what happened in the 1930s. That's the last thing we want.
Mm. Now, my understanding, and I want you to sort of take us back with some sort of basic explanation here, is that neither Freddie Mac or Fannie Mae invested in subprime mortgages because they weren't allowed to. So if that's the case, why did they end up in so much trouble in the wake of the subprime mortgage meltdown?
Well, I think the reality is not only did the subprime market melt down, but the conventional mortgage market, which is, of course, what Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are involved in, has also suffered greatly as a result of this worst housing recession we've had since World War II. So it was a variety of factors, but in particular that housing in general, not just the subprime sector, has been hurt. And, of course, with that, Fannie and Freddie.
Nariman Baravish is chief economist at Global Insight in Lexington, Massachusetts. Nariman, thanks for helping us today.
My pleasure.
And now an update from the front lines of the war in Afghanistan, which reached a grim milestone this summer. For two straight months, the death toll of U.S. and coalition troops surpassed the number of casualties in Iraq. And that was before yesterday's bold attack by Taliban insurgents killed 9 American soldiers at a remote base near the Pakistan border. It was the deadliest attack on U.S. forces in Afghanistan in 3 years and one of the fiercest since the American-led invasion in late 2001. Anna Mulrein is senior editor at U.S. News and World Report. She's just back in the U.S. after spending a month with U.S. soldiers and Marines in Afghanistan. And Anna, your thoughts first on this attack in Kunar province. You were in that province when you were with American forces recently. How does this attack fit in with what you saw there?
The fighters that waged this attack on this outpost, amassed in pretty large numbers. And that's one thing that soldiers are seeing over there. I mean, the Taliban, when you ask them what are the big contrasts between Iraq and their experiences on the ground there versus Afghanistan, I'll say, well, in Afghanistan, they encounter fighters who get together in groups of 20 or 30 and will, kind of strike head on. And generally, I mean, the U.S. forces tend to win those sorts of conflicts. I mean, they can call in air support. This is what you were seeing in this attack on Sunday. And I mean, essentially, these guys were doing surveillance on the outpost. I mean, that was something these soldiers who were out there, pretty much it's this old timber mill. There's not a lot around, not a lot of support. It's in the mountains. So they have Taliban fighters essentially that are constantly watching these outposts. They'll radio in. They'll look for a good time to strike when the soldiers there are fewer soldiers there at the outpost if some other platoon has gone out on a patrol. So it's to see something like that is pretty devastating for them.
So the insurgency, and I gathered this from your reporting, more coordinated, more organized than before. What does the insurgency look like today? How's it changed?
Well, it's interesting because you talk to military intelligence and analysts, and they'll tell you, they divide the insurgency into two groups. They, down south, where the Marines are fighting now with predominantly British forces in Helmand Province, it's kind of the traditional Taliban fighters. In the east, they call it a rainbow network, and they're fighting against Taliban insurgents as well as drug kingpins and warlords too. And two of the big warlords in that area are guys named Hikmatyar and Haqqani. And what they both have in common, they were both on the U.S. CIA payroll. We helped to support them to get the Soviets out of Afghanistan.
And now they're fighting us and trying to get us out of Afghanistan.
And right. Now they're trying to get us out. And in 2002, we tried to kill Haqqani in a Hellfire missile attack and obviously didn't succeed. But say more
about these two warlords. What are they like and what kind of troops are they? Or what kind of fighters are they commanding?
Well, Hikmatyar was a guy. He distinguished himself early on by throwing acid in the faces of unveiled women. He's extremely, very, very conservative. We interviewed Charlie Wilson for our latest article in the magazine this week, and he was saying that he remembered Hikmatyar as the most radical of the radicals. You know? And Charlie Wilson was saying, well, he didn't hate us as much as he hated the Soviets. But
Anna, we should just remind our listeners, Charlie Wilson, this, of course, the former congressman who had a lot to do with rounding up support for the Mujahideen when they were opposing Soviet forces in Afghanistan, right?
That's exactly it, yeah. And so he actually met with Hikmatyar. They brought Hikmatyar to the U.S., in 1985 to meet with folks on Capitol Hill. And then in 2002, the CIA shot a Hellfire missile from an unmanned drone in an effort to kill him. Haqqani is probably considered the best fighter by U.S. Defense officials. And Wilson was telling us how, he basically said he adored Haqqani. And when he was, when Charlie Wilson was in Afghanistan, Haqqani was the guy who would make sure he would get out. And he said in this interview we had with him that Haqqani was a marvelous leader and beloved in his territory. But he's also one of the leading advocates of this movement of Arab Afghans who came to, essentially wage war against the Soviet Union. He also helped to protect Osama bin Laden. Laden, and now he is on America's most wanted list in Afghanistan.
Well, an example of blowback, I guess, an example of former allies, now enemies today. One of the chief complaints by the Bush administration is Pakistan's involvement in the insurgencies. And you write that Hekmatyar and Haqqani's networks find sanctuary in Pakistan. What does that area look like? How do they do that?
They're operating there, you know, without any restraints. I mean, there's really no government presence in these areas. They have training camps. I was interviewing some Afghan National Army officials who had gone into those areas to kind of check it out, and they say, you know, these are very well organized training camps, and that's been a big problem. I mean, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen. He's the top U.S. military official in the country, and he was just recently, you know, basically made a stop in Pakistan over the weekend to kind of express his concern about these areas. But the border is extremely porous, and it's been that way, you know, for years. These tribal groups are you know, bisected by this border, and they'll go back and forth to do everyday business as well. I mean, up in this area of Kunar, you know, they'll regularly go back and forth across the border just to go to a market or to visit family that they have. I mean, the border really isn't recognized up in these areas, and you know, for that reason as well, it makes it pretty easy for fighters to move back and forth across the border.
Well, Anna, you've been painting a portrait here of increasing violence, and I'm really curious to hear what you found when you spent time with U.S. soldiers and Marines. And I'm interested in particular to hear what the captains and the colonels were telling you. Do they feel like this fight is passing them by? Or, I mean, do they feel that as though they're being overwhelmed by this fight, or is the morale still pretty good?
I was with the Marines in Helmand Province. So these are about 3,000 Marines that came into Afghanistan in March, the 24th MEU. And it was the same, this unit had been in Fallujah and also in Ramadi, and now they're in Afghanistan. They'll be there until October. They just found out they're actually going to be extended by 1 month. And you know, it's a tough fight for them. They're in this area, you know, in these outposts without any electricity, no running water, you know, and 120 degree temperatures. So, and carrying everything they need to carry on their backs, you know, so 150 pounds worth of stuff that they brought in to fight in these areas. Their big concern there is, all right, they're going to be there on the ground for 8 months, and then what happens when they leave? I mean, one of the, you know, generals down there kind of refers to it as mowing the lawn. So you have this idea, okay, you're going to clear these areas, but then what's going to happen when they leave? Who's going to backfill for them?
And we'll continue our conversation with Anna Mulrine after the break. Mulrine is senior editor at U.S. News and World Report. She's just back in the States after spending a month with U.S. soldiers and Marines in Afghanistan. Our conversation continues after the break. You're listening to Here and Now. And we're back with Anna Mulrine, senior editor at U.S. News and World Report. She's just back from Afghanistan. We're speaking to her the day after 9 American soldiers were killed in battle with insurgents in Kunar province, the deadliest day for American forces in Afghanistan in 3 years. And Anna, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Michael Mullen, has been talking about the need for more troops in Afghanistan. And there's talk about redeploying troops from Iraq to Afghanistan. They're also extending the deployment for a couple of thousand Marines by a month in Afghanistan. Is that going to be enough in your view?
Well, I mean, I think in the interim, it's better than nothing. I mean, one U.S. official we spoke with last week was saying, you know, he'd like to see 20,000, another 20,000 troops in Afghanistan. But the military is stretched so thin that, you know, you need to have these drawdowns in Iraq in order to put more troops in Afghanistan, and Mullen's been pretty clear on that. So I think that's something the Pentagon is certainly, you know, kind of doing its figures and you know, trying to figure out where they can put brigades, who they can pull out of Iraq. But certainly forces are going to have to come out of Iraq before they can go into Afghanistan.
Right. We should say 32,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan now, 25,000 allied troops under NATO control. that total is less than half the number of forces in Iraq.
Yeah, in a country that's a lot bigger than Iraq. Hmm. Afghanistan is.
What happened to the idea that NATO troops were supposed to sort of take over and pick up the lion's share of the burden here?
Well, I that was something you saw the Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, and Mullen, lobbying for pretty hard earlier this year. In fact, they kind of held off on announcing that U.S. Marines were going to go into Afghanistan because they wanted to kind of put the most pressure that they could on NATO and really try to get NATO countries to commit to more troops. And essentially what they ended up getting was just far below what they needed. So then they announced they were going to send in these 3,200 Marines, so 2,000 Marines to do kind of heavy fighting and another 1,200 to train Afghan security forces, which is another huge need in the country, especially if these forces are going to end up, backfilling and taking over the places where the Marines, when the Marines leave in November. But they didn't get the force levels that they need, and so now they're forced to send in the Marines. I think they haven't stopped lobbying with NATO countries, but, it's they're hard pressed, and I think, slowly coming to the realization that U.S. forces they're going to have to up the levels there. I mean, they've repeatedly said, well, this Marine deployment is a one-time deal. When they announced it, they said it's one time. We're not going to repeat it. But I think around the Pentagon halls, they're pretty skeptical of that.
And I'm interested in what you picked up when you were over there on your recent trip from the Afghan people. Hundreds of Afghan civilians have been killed in U.S. attacks. The International Committee of the Red Cross issued a plea asking that all sides show restraint to avoid civilian casualties. Are U.S. forces winning hearts and minds over there? What did you pick up?
Well, you go to a place like Kabul, and I mean, what I found most striking, you walk through the marketplaces and kind of, do interviews there and just kind of talk with people on the street. And you find that, by and large, this is a country where the people are just so used to war. I mean, they've been at war for two decades. It's almost hard to characterize, but there's almost a higher tolerance level there in Afghanistan than in Iraq. I mean, they're used to war. And by and large, they still support U.S. troops. I mean, you look at surveys that they'll do periodically. It's those figures tend to be in about the 70% support for U.S. troops, which is striking. And I mean, U.S. military officials would say it's striking too, given the length of this war and,
sure,
and how long it's gone on. But it's still just growing frustration with what they regard as the corruption within the Afghan government. I talked to a woman on the street, and just a neat looking woman, very put together, and her son, who kind of had very funky modern glasses on, and she was saying that she cannot get her son a job. He's got a university education, and the reason she can't is she can't afford to pay the bribe that she needs to pay in order to get him a job. And she said, believe me, I have no moral compunctions. If I could afford to pay this bribe, I would, but I can't. Mm. He's out of work. That's one big concern, the corruption. The other is the rising price of food. You go around, it was watermelon season when I was there, so these big watermelons on, these donkey carts that they'll pull, and the, bakeries that sell the flatbread in the market. And watermelon's a favorite snack, and right now Afghan families are having a hard time affording it. They're also having a hard time affording wheat, which is particularly frightening for families. I mean, essentially a 40-pound bag of wheat was costing about $40, and when you consider that the average monthly salary for an Afghan worker is about $60 a month, and that's for, people who are lucky enough to have jobs. I mean, the unemployment rate, official unemployment rate, is around 40%, some say that's a little bit underestimated. And so there's that frustration, and fear about the growing price of food. How do people support their families? How do they get jobs? And I think you're starting to see that anxiety level creep up in Kabul.
Well, Anna, we're just about out of time, but in the few seconds that remain, I want to ask one final question about Osama bin Laden. We've heard for a long time that he might be in that remote border area between Afghanistan and Pakistan that you were mentioning. What did you hear about that while you were there? Is there an aggressive search for him?
I mean, I'd have to say right now, no. You know, I mean, you'll talk to U.S. officials who say, well, we've marginalized him. You know, he's certainly not our focus. They have their hands full with border incursions. You definitely hear that he's in these ungoverned tribal territories, and that's where he's finding sanctuary and protection, you know, from people like Hekmatyar and the Haqqani network. You also occasionally hear he's in a place like Kunar, up where they had these horrible attacks over the weekend. And I think that, you know, the bottom line is they still don't know.
Mm. Well, Anna, thanks so much for that report from the front lines in Afghanistan. Very grateful to you.
Oh, well, thanks so much for having me.
Sure. That's Anna Mulrine. She's a senior editor at U.S. News and World Report, just back in the U.S. after spending a month with U.S. soldiers and Marines in Afghanistan. And you can read her stories by going to our website, here-now.org. Thanks again, Anna.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Here and Now. It was Ben Franklin who said, "Nothing is certain except death and taxes." The bit about death is true everywhere, but when it comes to taxes, residents of one town in Cook County, Illinois, are saying enough is enough. They're so outraged by high taxes, they're considering secession. Here's the background. This month, Cook County commissioners voted to raise the sale tax by a full percentage point, pushing the local tax burden up to 10.25%. That means the county, including the city of Chicago, now has one of the highest sales tax rates in the nation. And that doesn't sit well with the residents of Palatine, Illinois, a Chicago suburb, who are trying to repeal the tax hike. If they fail, some say they will try to secede from the county. Joining us from her home is the mayor of Palatine, Rita Mullins. And Mayor Mullins, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
Well, let's start at the beginning. This 1% sales tax hike won by a 9-8 vote in the Cook County Board. Why was the hike proposed in the first place?
They have a deficit. They have a deficit of $232 million. But the proposed tax increase is supposed to raise $436 million. The board asked the county to account for what have you done to do belt tightening, what have you done to cut expenditures, what have you done to look elsewhere. We never got a report. We never got answers.
Well, the Cook County Board voted to raise the tax at the end of February after what I understand was a long sort of 5 months of stalemate and debate on the budget. When the tax hike finally passed, what was the reaction by people in your town?
Well, we're worried about the existing businesses and any future businesses that we hope to attract to come here. We happen to be situated on what we call the Cook County Cliff. Literally across the street, it's a road called Lake Cook Road that divides counties. The sales tax is 7% in the neighboring county. So that puts us at a disadvantage for economic development.
Now, I understand there's a campaign currently underway by residents of Palatine who are writing protest letters to the board and enclosing a tea bag, a reference, I guess, to another tax rebellion in U.S. history.
Absolutely. The people have had enough. We feel that the state government, the federal government are all coming down on us, and this is a county government.
Well, if the sales tax is not repealed or at least lower, I understand there are other plans. Is seceding from Cook County really an option? Do you think it's going to come to that? Are you going to have your own version of a sort of Cook County Tea Party?
Well, there is not a Lincoln County in Illinois, and so we already have a name. But you need over 50% of the people that want to secede and 50% of the people that you're trying to secede from to approve it. So what is happening now is we have a state senator and a state representative that are trying to make it easier to secede by state legislation.
I see. Interesting. Well, Rita Mullins, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Well, thank you.
Rita Mullins is the mayor of Palatine, Illinois, in Cook County, which now has among the highest sales taxes in the nation. To get some perspective on this story, we're going to turn to a tax expert. William Wheaton is a professor of economics at MIT. He's an authority on regional economics and local government finance. And Professor Wheaton, thanks for coming in.
Delighted to be here.
Okay, Professor Wheaton, we just heard about the concerns of people in Cook County, Illinois, who are now paying a sales tax of 10.25%. How does that strike you? Is that very high?
Well, it depends on how you look at it, Anthony. In fact, the 10.25 for Cook County is just about as high as it gets around the country among major cities. You can find smaller areas that we could talk about later that where you actually pay a little higher tax than that. Well, I think the important point to realize is that not all of that 10.25 is going to the county, that the way sales taxes work in the U.S. is you start with a state-level sales tax rate, which in the case of Illinois is about 6.5%. And then the state authorizes counties and even cities to add to that.
I see. So in this case, it's unfair to blame the county board for this very high tax burden. That is, they're not responsible for that entire
tax
burden.
That's exactly right. The county rate in this case, I think, is 1.75%, and it went from 1% to 1.75%. So the county rate actually doubled, and that added about a percentage point to the total tax burden of residents of Cook County.
Well, I'm interested to hear you say that there are other places that you know of where the tax burden is even higher. For example,
resort towns are well known, such as Aspen, Colorado, to have very high local tax burdens. And in the case of Aspen, I think they have about 11% local sales tax on top of a 3% state rate. So it's about 14%. And you can see that those cities and towns do it because they're really trying to tax visitors, in this case skiers, to the town and get them to pay for most of the city's services.
Getting back to Cook County, though, the county raised taxes by a percentage point to close a budget deficit. I'm wondering, is there a risk that raising taxes too high could actually worsen a budget situation?
It's very, very hard to see that happening. Obviously, cities and towns, particularly in the current state of the economy, are stressed. They're looking for new sources of revenue. So when they raise taxes, the idea that they could scare off enough business, scare off enough sales so they'd actually lower the revenue is pretty hard to see. It's certainly true that the residents of certain cities and of Cook County couldn't go across the county boundary and save possibly 2 or 3 percentage points on the tax rate. But they're going to spend a lot of gasoline to do that. And 2 or 3% isn't a lot unless you're buying a car. And I think cars are actually exempt from this tax in Illinois.
Well, because we just heard from the mayor just a few minutes ago that she's concerned about people literally crossing the street in her town and then they pass into a different county. So she's worried about local businesses on the Cook County side really being drained of customers. Not a realistic concern.
This is actually an old problem along boundary lines. If the taxes between two states or between two counties within a state gets more than a couple percentage points out of whack, you have all these boundary lines where businesses will decide to relocate to the low tax side of the boundary line or open up their stores or their shopping center on the low tax side. And in those situations, it can actually lead to a reduction in the rateable value of property within the high taxing jurisdiction. And it is a little bit of a cause of concern. You don't want cities and towns, very local governments, to have big differences in tax rates because it leads to sort of situations like this.
Finally, we heard that some folks in Cook County are pretty upset about this, understandably, some of them talking about secession from the county, even a tax revolt. We heard stories of sending tea bags to the county board. Aside from the famous Boston Tea Party that helped spark a revolution, do we know of any sort of major tax revolts at a local level that actually made a difference?
No, and the threat of secession actually exists. The most recent example was the ski village of Killington, Vermont, which was threatening to secede from Vermont, and they wanted to go over to New Hampshire. They were upset, again, because in that case, the particular state property tax was really hitting second homes very hard. So a resort like that was hard hit. But there's no real meaningful example of secession that's actually ever occurred.
Okay, well, thanks very much for coming in and straightening this out for us.
Okay.
That's William Wheaton. He's a professor in the MIT Economics Department. He also teaches real estate economics at the MIT Center for Real Estate. And still ahead on the program, the return of the cable TV super hit, The Closer. You're listening to Here and Now. When parents lay down rules about dating, their hope is to guide their teenagers through some of life's more fraught waters. And parents probably have a lot to offer. For example, researchers have known for some time that teenagers who are close to their parents are less prone to risky sexual behavior. But a new study suggests that the rules parents set for their teenagers may also have a lot to say about their own love lives. Dr. Stephanie Madsen is an associate professor of psychology at McDaniel College in Maryland. She's author of the new study, and she joins us now. Welcome, Dr. Madsen.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So you surveyed nearly 200 parents, more than 100 teenagers. And before we talk about the central finding of that study, what were the different ways that parents handled teen dating that you found?
I asked parents about the rules they had for dating, and 64% of the parents did set dating rules for their late adolescents. These were 17 to 19-year-olds. And I found that there are three main types of rules. And the most commonly set rule was supervision rules, and these were rules that allowed the parents to get information about the dating partner or the dating activities. So rules saying that they had to meet the date, they needed to know when you'd be back and where you're going.
That's supervision. Okay.
Supervision rule, yes. Also pretty common were restriction rules, and these were rules that prohibited some aspect of dating. So rules about who you can't date, curfews, rules like no dates on a school night. And then just 16% of the rules fell into the third category, and these were prescription rules. And these were rules, they were more like advice-giving rules. They set expectations about how to behave on a date. So rules like you have to return the date's phone calls, or you have to be a gentleman or a lady, or rules not to let someone walk all over you.
Okay, prescription rules. So we have supervision rules, restriction rules, and prescription rules.
That's right.
So let's move on to the most interesting part of the study. You ask these parents about their own love lives, and how did that relate to the kind of dating rules that they set?
Well, parents who are unhappy in their own love lives reported low satisfaction and low closeness and high insecurity. These parents tended to use a lot more of the prescription rules, the advice-giving rules. And this link was strongest for mothers of sons.
Strongest for mothers of sons. So what does that tell you?
Well, I think there are two possibilities about what's going on here. So it could be that these rules are kind of intrusive and inappropriate, that the mom is trying to live vicariously through their kids' own romantic lives. And certainly children who had a lot of prescriptive rules did see their parents as being more psychologically controlling, so they weren't as happy about these rules. The other possibility, though, is that these are mothers who really know how hard it is to have a good relationship and how important that is, and so they're really giving very well-intentioned advice here to help their children along the way. We do know from past research that mothers who recall lots of anxiety around their own peer relationships give their children more advice about how to form good friendships, and that actually does help them form good friendships. So maybe that's a more, benevolent motivation there.
And what did you find out about the love lives of parents who offered the other kinds of rules, supervision rules and restriction rules?
Their love lives didn't vary at all. They weren't more or less likely to use the other types of rules. Parents who use supervision rules tended to be more comfortable in their parenting roles in general. Mm-hmm. And there was a trend that parents who use more restriction rules had children with closer romantic relationships.
And so any conclusions about what type of rules are best for teens? You said some rules can have a Romeo and Juliet effect. What do you mean by that?
Parents who place a lot of restrictions on their teens' dating, they tend to have teens with closer relationships. So it could be that this is driving the teens closer together. It could also be that the parents are reacting to a close relationship by wanting to put the brakes on.
Well, what were your parents like? What kind of dating rules did they put on you? And is that what led to your interest in this study?
I was a pretty tame dater, and I did actually call my mother up and ask her if we had any dating rules. And she said we did. We had a lot of supervision rules. I had to let them know where I was going and when I was going to come back and call if my plans changed. They had to meet the date. But on the other hand, I was a pretty good kid and probably didn't push a lot of boundaries. So it could be that parents who have this high-quality parent-child relationship have the luxury of setting supervision rules, and parents where things are a little more rocky tend to fall towards the restriction and the prescription rules.
That's Dr. Stephanie Madsen. She's an associate professor of psychology at McDaniel College in Maryland. Her study looked at how parents' love lives influence the dating rules they set for their kids. Thanks so much for talking about this with us today.
My pleasure.
Coming up, we meet Tony Dennison from the program The Closer, one of cable TV's top-rated shows. Stay with us here and now. Tonight, one of the top-rated series on cable television, The Closer, begins its fourth season on TNT. Kira Sedgwick returns as Deputy Chief Brenda Lee Johnson, the Atlanta-born, Los Angeles-based homicide detective known for her ability to close tough cases. In tonight's episode, the case involves a body found at an arson site in the middle of Griffith Park. Brenda's job in this case is complicated by her boss, who tells her that because he's under pressure, she's going to be shadowed by a journalist.
I get orders too, okay? And mine were absolutely clear in this case. Improve relations between LAPD and the media. That is what I am doing. Commander Taylor is assisting me, and I expect your enthusiastic cooperation.
Fine, well, whatever you want.
Besides, it's a big story. I'd rather have him reporting it from inside than guessing from out on the street. He might even prove to be an asset.
Yes, journalists. They're so helpful. We'll want them on every case.
I take it this is your attempt at enthusiasm?
I'm sorry. I meant to say yippee.
She's not enthusiastic about journalists. I don't understand that. Though Kira Sedgwick has won a Golden Globe for her role as the closer, the show's supporting cast has also won acclaim, including two nominations from the Screen Actors Guild for Best Ensemble in a Drama Series. One cast member is Toni Denison, who has appeared on the TV series Crime Story. Here and Now's Emiko Tamagawa caught up with Denison in Boston during a screening of tonight's episode. She asked him about his character, Lieutenant Andy Flynn, who first appeared on The Closer.
I was told by some of the producers that they said, when you watch the pilot, you know, you see Toni Denison and you know him from a whole bunch of different things and you think, well, he's the lead of the show. And then all of a sudden, Kira comes along and like kicks him to the curb and they have this big fight. And they thought, you know, how interesting that the show makes this turn.
I beg your pardon, ma'am.
Yes, Lieutenant.
I don't know who you think you are, but we were assigned this case by Captain Taylor.
Well, there's been a change of plans. Look, since you're getting emotional about this, why don't we
I don't get emotional. I am damned angry.
Well, thank you for speaking your mind. Look, I hate to pull rank on my very first week, but I think it would be best if you handed your notes over to Sergeant Gabriel here, took a deep breath, and went on back to your car. I can get what I need from your partner here. Waters.
And there was a real transition there, because for the longest time it wasn't entirely clear that your character would stay, because he was sort of a holdover from the previous regime.
Exactly. That's why they decided to have my character be a reluctant member of the squad, so that I could be a sort of thorn in her side.
One of the things that's a lot of fun to watch in the show is Lieutenant Flynn and Lieutenant Provenza, played by D.W. Bailey. The episode that I think a lot of people would really remember for that relationship, of course, is To Protect and to Serve, which is in the second season. Your character and Lieutenant Provenza discover a body, and then what happens?
Provenza says, well, because she's dead, we have these tickets for a baseball game, a Dodger game. We have skybox tickets, which, you know, for a working man like a cop, they're hard to come by. And so he says, look, she's dead. What difference does it make? We'll go watch the game for a couple hours. We'll come back, and then we'll file the report. And, you know, the fact that I agree to that, it's just, you know, it's like you think, that's a terrible idea. But it's like, you know what? Well, you're right. She's dead. What difference does it make? And then all manner of madness ensues. And it's a very funny episode. In fact, as I understand it, it's still today one of the fans' favorites.
Take off those idiotic baseball caps. Lieutenant Provenza, tell me about the death of this woman.
The victim looked like she'd been dead 3-4 hours when we found her.
Well, that's true, Chief. Rigor mortis had set in, but there was very little lividity. In fact, if you take a look at these pictures...
You didn't have time to call it in, but you had time to take pictures?
I wanted to call it in.
Oh, yeah, sure, may. Yeah. Blame it all on me.
Well, it's your damn garage. Look, I'm not going down for this.
You rat!
Enough, both of you!
It is one of those things, though, about Lieutenant Flynn, because he, every once in a while, he gets a little bit close to the edge.
Yes, that's the nature of, you know, he says, okay, tell me what the rules are, tell me what the boundaries are. And he tests them each time to see how flexible they are. Are they made of plastic or are they made of elastic? And we have this little running gag on the set, or every episode, is that Lieutenant Flynn is always right. But because he has communication difficulties, like, you know, he's not the politician like Kira's character can be, Flynn, he comes in, he goes, no, it's not that guy, and let's just go arrest him, you know. let's go arrest the other. And so, but he, the funny joke is that he's always right, but just doesn't have the same joie de vivre as Kira. And interestingly enough, even Kira's character can be very abrasive, but not nearly as abrasive as Lieutenant Flynn.
The cast of The Closer has been nominated for SAG Acting Awards as an ensemble, and there are very defined characters and lots of different relationships. However, as the promos always say, Kira Sedgwick is the closer. How do you work with that? I mean, to sort of define your niche within that?
Well, this is truly like a single lead show with a really wonderful ensemble supporting this lead. Each actor gets, you know, their chance to shine. Some, you know, obviously get a little more than others. But at the end of the day, the closer is Kira. And we're all the ones that make the closer's life the life that it is. It's like, you know, in a baseball game, you know, each scene is like an inning, you know, to try to score a run. And even though, let's say, Kira is like Mickey Mantle or the Ted Williams of the team, they don't get up every inning, or at least every inning they don't get a hit. Sometimes they just move a runner over. Sometimes her job or my job or G.W. Bailey's job in a scene is to get the runner from first to second, and then it's somebody else's, John Tenney, Corey Reynolds, or J.K. Simmons. It's their job to, like, you know, hit the long fly ball that the guy can score from second on. And you don't really know that until the scene's over. When you look at it in retrospect, you can say, oh, yeah, I was the sort of the setup man. I was the guy running the bases. Or my job was to steal the, oh, I get it, I stole second, or I bunted. Because, you know, it would get boring if every scene or every time up, you know, maybe not the Red Sox fans, but every time Ted Williams got up, every single time he hit a home run, and then the challenge of the idea of the strikeout, or maybe, you know, will he get it, you know, it's the idea that you could strike out that makes the home run that much more exciting. So that's the same thing applies to Kira's character. If every single scene she comes out on top by herself without help from anybody else, then it becomes uninteresting.
Look, all I did was ask a few questions.
You can't ask people questions without telling them what you want to know. I need his notes and tapes from his
what?
Crowley,
no,
his photograph,
no way.
His camera,
it's against the law
everything.
For you to demand my notes, and I will not surrender them.
With a murder
Listen, the First Amendment allows
to
me
aid
to speak to the whomever.
You want to hear about
I against
the law?
To.
I'd be more than happy to oblige.
It's the perfect marriage of an actress and a role and a character. They didn't make a show to say, well, let's try to make a show that would appeal to people in New York and Boston and California and Des Moines, Iowa, and, you know, in Dallas, Texas. Let's just do a show about a really strong female detective and have her have all of the, you know, the difficulties and problems that anybody would have. And then you wind up with this really wonderful actress playing this, you know, intense character. So you wind up with these really good characters, her characters, our characters, and strong plots. In our show, the plots happen to be, like, really important and really elaborate. It was one day when we were doing, we'd read through each episode before we do the show, and John Tenney and I, at the end of one of the read-throughs, we said, oh, my God, it was the hairdresser who was the, I never could figure that out. So that's how good the plots are. You're reading the script and you don't even know.